dearest ones, about this matter of cohabitation, one might call it. I know it is hard for you to accept the idea of gents and ladies all under one roof, but practically, in terms of expense, it is not possible for me to live alone. The only way you can beat the rent racket is to get a large place and share it, and I couldn't stand living with four or five girls, dormitory fashion, stockings drying all over the place.
Welcome to Book Tour. I am Netta Ulaby. This week, we hear from Judith Jones. She's the editor who discovered Julia Child. Jones discovers food and her lifelong love of it in her memoir, The Tenth Muse. Jones grew up in the kind of household that banned garlic and considered food talk crude. When she visited Paris on a vacation, Jones stayed for 3.5 years. Julia Child is just one of the many cooks Jones ushered into American kitchens over the past 50 years. She also introduced us to Claudia Rowan's Middle Eastern cookbooks and Edna Lewis's beloved Southern recipes. This discussion of The Tenth Muse took place in December of 2007 at the Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C.
I almost called this book, Do I Really Like Garlic? And then I came across this, in Brillat-Savarin's The Physiology of Taste, this wonderful passage about how there was a muse for art, for music, for dance, for drama, but no muse for taste. And so he decided to dub the tenth muse as Gastaria, who presides over the pleasures of taste. And I thought that really said it for me. I felt very strongly that that's exactly what I want to try to convey in this book. And so reluctantly, I gave up the garlic title. But it is true that my mother, when she was in her 90s, she called me over and she said, Judith, I have a very important question to ask you. And I thought, whoops, you know, do I believe in an afterlife? What is this going to be? And she said, Judith, do you really like garlic? And of course I said yes, and I could see that crestfallen look on her face that this wayward daughter was beyond redemption. So I guess I was, and I think a lot of my love of food came out of protest because I knew there was more exciting stuff out there and I had to find a way of experiencing it. But you know that my mother was, her family was English, and the English have always been suspicious of French food. You don't put a sauce on something if it's good. It may be hiding something rotten. And but it was pretty typical of America at the time. I mean, it was the time of the poor little woman. It's demeaning to go into the kitchen and spend all that time. You don't want to dirty yourself up. Heaven knows you don't want your house smelling of garlic. And it was also a kind of wasteland in the supermarkets. There weren't even supermarkets then. But there was so little that you could really buy. And the whole food industry was trying to persuade us that we didn't need to cook. We needed them. Fast and easy. That's what America needed. But there was obviously, I had some fluke gene because when I got home from school, I would always head to the kitchen. And we had a wonderful maid from Barbados who, maid of all work, she was the cook. And I would sit in the kitchen and watch her as she took a big bowl, ceramic bowl, and the wooden spoon. I could still hear it plopping as she was beating a batter for a nice cake. And I would ask her, she lived in Harlem, and I would say, what are you going to make for your boyfriend for dinner this weekend or Sunday and Thursday nights with the nights off? And it was so romantic to me, I just knew I had to experience that someday. And I also had an aunt up in Vermont who loved to cook, and her husband was one of the GPs in town, so he never got home until later, 9 o'clock, and after his final calls. And she would always have a lovely dinner for him, and I would watch her prepare it. And I would think, you know, that cooking with love was such an expression of her feelings about her household, her family. So that got to me. And also another thing, when I stayed with my grandmother, who wasn't much of a cook, but she had somebody named Mrs. Cooney in the kitchen. And one night I heard a commotion in the kitchen, and I was up on the second floor, and you know those little gratings you could look through? So the heat went up, and I used to spy down in the kitchen. And I saw she was feeding these sort of scruffy men, and they were laughing and enjoying it and thanking her. And I watched the whole scene. And the next day I said to her, "Who were those people?" And she said, "Well, they were hobos. There were poor men looking for work." This was during the Depression. And so we always feed them. She said, "Your grandmother told me always to take care of them." And actually, there was a sign on the elm tree outside the kitchen door that was a little code that said to other hobos, "You can get a good meal here," or "You're welcome." And I felt so proud of that. It was something that really spoke to me in a funny way. It always has stayed with me. So it was inevitable that I would want to go to Paris. And after I had my first job, a good job at Doubleday as a junior editor, and I went off for a three-week vacation, which I got extended, and it ended up that I stayed 3.5 years. Now, I had a little help through an accident. I don't think Freud would call it an accident. But anyway, I was supposed to be going home and in a few days, and I was sitting in the Tuileries Gardens, and I was looking at the light of Paris and thinking of all the good meals I'd had and what was it I loved about it. So, and wishing I could stay, and I got up, leaving my purse on the back of the bench, and put my book under my arm, and just forgot about the purse until I'd walked a couple of blocks. And needless to say, when I went back to get it, it was gone. My passport was gone, my ticket home, my traveler's checks. In other words, little Judy Bailey's identity was gone. And I just took it as a sign that this was meant to be. And I would follow that sign, follow my muse. So I did. And I had a hard time finding jobs. But at one point, I ran into an old friend who had worked at Doubleday. And I told him I was broke and looking for a job. And he said, "Well, look, I'm living in my aunt's apartment. It's a big apartment on the Rue de Cerque. And my aunt is the Princess Caetani, and she's in Rome. And so there are plenty of rooms, so why don't you just move in?" And then he said, "There's also a painter living down the hall, but he goes to his studio during the day." The painter turned out to be Baltus. I'd never heard of him then. But so, sure, I moved in. And then we decided, Paul and I, that if we could feed others, we'd be able to feed ourselves. In other words, that's known as a restaurant, right? And so I had a very sophisticated French boyfriend then who was, he was a newsman working for Gaumont Activités, that was a wonderful cook, and he loved showing me what French food should be, this ignorant little American. And I kind of thought that it would appeal to him to be our chef. And indeed, he fell for it. And so Paul and I were his little sous chefs. And believe me, we worked all day long. Just one example, I went with Pierre to the market, and he started putting all these fish into my shopping bag, one after the other. I've never gone down, racasse, you name it. And I said, "What are we having for dinner tonight? What is the restaurant serving tonight? Are we serving fish?" And he said, no, "We're a soup de poisson. And you and young Paul will have to put all of the flesh through a tamis, which is a fine sieve." So we spent all afternoon creating this wonderful soup de poisson. Anyway, I wrote to my parents after this event, trying to find a way to describe it. And it started out, I think, I know you didn't send me to an expensive college to become a cook, but in France, cookery is considered an art. And the letter went on trying to persuade him. In fact, it was discovering this batch of letters in my mother's attic after she died, all the letters that I had written home during those 3.5 years in Paris, that sort of got me started on writing. I couldn't believe this young woman of 24. She was so sure of herself and so audacious and so manipulative. And I kind of wanted to get to know her. So that was the beginning of sort of a journey of discovery, really. And I'll just have to read you one other little manipulative letter. This was after the so-called restaurant had been closed down because the concierge wrote to the princess in Rome, and the princess was on the next train. She never said a word about the restaurant. She just said there was going to be a family wedding and we'd have to clear out. But so then I later found a job at the magazine called Weekend, run by a Mr. Jones, and he and some of the editors all had a big apartment, so I moved in there. And this is what I wrote my parents. Dearest ones, about this matter of cohabitation, one might call it, I know it is hard for you to accept the idea of gents and ladies all under one roof, but practically in terms of expense, it is not possible for me to live alone. The only way you can beat the rent racket is to get a large place and share it, and I couldn't stand living with 4 or 5 girls, dormitory fashion, stockings drying all over the place. And then I went on to say they had a little Alsatian maid who was going to cook for them, and ending, that means I shan't be cooking for the boys, which I know you were distressed about. So anyway, that honeymoon in Paris was over, and we had to come back to this country for many reasons. And it was so shocking to me because it just seemed a wasteland. After having the joy of going to the French markets and things so beautifully ripe and so beautifully displayed and so much choice and the sheer joy that the French took, or the Parisians certainly, in shopping sometimes 2 and 3 times a day and standing in line at the charcuterie. This was shortly after the war, and sometimes they'd be in pretty shabby clothes with a toe sticking through a pair of slippers. But believe me, they spent their last sou at the charcuterie or whatever, the fromagerie. And I remember one day I was in the boulangerie, because we'd always go every morning to get our warm croissants and our and a loaf of baguette. And suddenly a shout went up, and I looked at this man. He'd torn open the bread, and he was passing it around, and each person picked up this shout of joy. And I thought, what is this? And I asked somebody and said, the flour is white. It had been just sort of polluted granary floor flour all through the war. And there was something that just heartened me so about that. But back in New York, could you find a baguette? No. So it was kind of a wasteland, and I wanted to be able to cook French style with that finesse. I wanted to understand the techniques. I wanted to be able to buy some shallots and leeks and things like that. And to my great piece of luck, I now had a job at Knopf, and I was sort of a literary editor working mostly with French translations. But everybody knew that I had spent that time in Paris and I did like to cook. So when this huge tome on French cooking came in, written by somebody named Julia Child and 2 French women, and it was dumped on my desk because I think they thought it would amuse me and I'd read a few pages and probably reject it. Not at all. I started to read this, and I felt as though my prayer had been answered. Here was a book that really taught you the basics. The meat to buy for a bourguignon, for instance. how you would brown it in the pan, not too many pieces at a time, always dried carefully, using butter, but a little bit of oil so the butter wouldn't burn. I mean, it went on for pages. But once you learned it, it was as though you had just graduated from your first course. And anyway, I spent a month cooking this book and this manuscript, and I was just so excited about it. And fortunately, old Alfred Knopf decided to let Mrs. Jones have a chance. He was a bit of a gastronome himself, not the kind who ever went in the kitchen, but he went to Food and Wine Society parties and things like that. So he was sort of predisposed. He was a little suspicious of this big Smith College girl writing it. And when I finally told him what we decided on for the title, I said, it's going to be Mastering the Art of French Cooking. And he said, if a book by that title sells, I'll eat my hat. So he ate lots of hats. Anyway, this opened a whole world to me, because I realized that cookbooks shouldn't just be a collection of formula recipes, the shorter the better, because then you think it's quick. I mean, that's a whole deception, that you had to take people by the hand and teach them and explain. And ever more so if you're talking about an exotic cuisine, where we're really flying blind. I mean, we may be making a dish that we've never even tasted. So you need somebody there to tell you this is what to look for, this is how it should be. So I went in pursuit of people to do books that would really bring this whole world to us. And I was very fortunate. One of the first ones was Claudia Roden with her book of Middle Eastern food. And we didn't know what Middle Eastern food was in this country. I mean, all the wonderful Greek places served steak and French fries. And it's as though Julia really opened us up to the acceptance of food, and it was something to enjoy, something to talk about. And she paved the way, in a sense, for all of these different, perhaps less known, somewhat more exotic cuisines. And anyway, after the Claudia Roden book, I did Madhur Jaffrey on an invitation to Indian cooking. And I spent quite a few years looking for somebody to do a really good book on Chinese cooking, and found Irene Kuo, who had a gift for language. She talked about velveting little pieces of chicken, slippery coating them. You could practically eat the words. They're so seductive. And an interesting thing I found a lot of these writers had in common was they were people who had been briefly torn away from the place of their childhood. And the dishes that they associated with the past, with family, with memory, were what they wanted to recreate to make that tie again. And also because many of them, like Madhur Jaffrey and Sydney Claudia, learned to cook later in life. They didn't just cook at grandma's knee because it was all done in the kitchen out there. They had to learn the way you and I had to, so they understood all the things that they needed to explain. And cooking as memory is something that I think is a very, very important factor. Every recipe has a story. And the truth is, you don't really make a recipe exactly the same way twice. I mean, not a home cook. So that it has a past, it's constantly changing and evolving, and that's what makes cooking fun and creative. I think the other big factor that sort of changed or was part of this journey, did change my thinking about food, was when Evan and I should say my husband loved to cook, and he started writing about food. He had been writing about American history, and he realized that food is so much a part of history, and yet it's never in the history books. And so we wanted to tell this whole story of American food. And it was a book that in some ways was before its time, but it has been recently republished. Anyway, we shared this experimentation, went on lots of trips together. And when we were doing a bread book together, and we wanted to find a little place away from my family enclave up in Vermont where we could be by ourselves and get this book done. And we rented this just glorious house, quirky house on a mountain, really remote, and about 56 acres. And we just fell in love with it. Unfortunately, the man who had built it sort of overspent, and he wanted to get rid of it. So, again, that was one of those extraordinary lucky things. But what happened was that for the first time, we had a garden, and it's very tough to grow things in the Northeast Kingdom of Vermont. And I began to realize that how climate so affects taste, and how, for instance, I did a piece on the lemons of the North, how northern people will use things like gooseberries and sorrel and rhubarb for that tart accent. But it was mostly that fun of growing things and rushing them from the garden right up into the kitchen and then exploring the woods. We had a wonderful naturalist friend who walked the woods and the pastures with us. And I learned so much about things that are just gifts there, ready for the plucking. And also in recent years, I've come I'm very cautious, but I have found some beds of chanterelles and morels up in Vermont, particularly chanterelles. And anyway, it has added to that whole sense of where your food comes from and how you treat it, I think greatly enriches your cooking. And then I have also been influenced greatly by two recent books, both Fast Food Nation and The Omnivore's Dilemma. And it is so horrifying what we have allowed the food industry and agribusiness to do to our farms, to the raising of beef for the table and the poultry farms. I mean, so that it's time, I think, for us to protest, even if it's in the smallest way, of caring about the sources of your food. And that led me to suggest to my former cousin who lives on the same mountain up in Vermont that maybe we should start a little start with a few Angus cattle and just raise them for grass-fed, locally grown beef, not on a big scale, on a small scale. So we got our first 6 Angus about a year ago, and they were all certified pregnant. And sure enough, in the spring, the first little calf arrived, and that night, it was early March, that night it was 37 below. And my cousin John and his wife went out to bring the extra grass. The cattle were all huddled together in their shelter. And they found this little calf on the ground, almost frozen. So they put him in their little Subaru and went chugging up the hill to their farm, stoked up the stove, got out the hair dryer, found a sweater of their son's. And in about half an hour, this little creature was on his legs, looking around, saying, "I want my mother's milk." So they had to go out into the 37 below again, and the little calf had his fill. But then the mother started licking him all over, which was the worst thing she could have done because he started to freeze again. So once again, they took him back to the kitchen, made a little pen, and he spent the first couple of days in that kitchen. And I just had that feeling that I'm not certain how I'll feel when he goes to market. But I do know that he's been brought up with very tender, loving care, and it makes a huge difference. I just want to read one quote that Wendell Berry wrote in The Unsettling of America. "If you take away from food the wholeness of growing it, or take away the joy and conviviality of preparing it in your own home, then I believe you are talking about a whole new definition of the human being. I think that's a lovely quote. And lastly, the last chapter really deals with, after my husband died, I wasn't sure that I would really enjoy food as much, or that I could really sit down together to dinner with myself just as company. But I will read you just this passage. After Evan died in the winter of 1996, I doubted that I would ever find pleasure in making a nice meal for myself and sitting down to eat it all alone. I was wrong. Instead, I realized that the ritual we had shared together for almost 50 years was a part of the rhythm of my life, and by honoring it, I kept alive something that was deeply ingrained in our relationship. In fact, more than ever, I found myself about mid-afternoon letting my mind drift toward what I was going to conjure up for dinner that night when I got home. Instead of walking into what might have seemed an empty apartment, I gravitate toward the kitchen, as I did as a young girl, to bask in Edie's warmth, and I can't wait to bring it to life, to fill it with good smells, to start chopping or whisking or tossing and smelling up my hands with garlic. I turn on some music and have a glass of Campari or wine, and it is for me the best part of the day, a time for relaxation. When at last I sit down and light the candles, the place across me from me is not empty. And another thing I just want to add, I went on a trip with Lydia Bastianich, and we went to a farm where they made cheeses, and this young woman who made the cheese, the whole family was involved in the enterprise, and I think it was her father, her grandfather, who was probably in his 90s, and he kept kind of looking at me as if to say, what are you doing here at your age? And finally he said to me, how old are you? And so Lydia gave me this quote, which I think is wonderful. There is an old Italian saying, a tavola non si invecchia, at the table one never grows old. Isn't that reason enough to come home at the end of the day, roll up one's sleeves, fire up the stove, and start smashing the garlic? As Brillat Savarin wrote, the pleasures of the table are for every man, of every land, and no matter of what place in history or society. They can be part of all his other pleasures, and they last the longest to console him when he has outlived the rest. So.
Do you have a favorite cuisine? Is it still French?
Well, I think I use French technique more than anything, but because I'm always working on books, too, I'm always stimulated by what I'm working on. So it might be Northern Italian for a few months. And recently I've been doing a wonderful book with Anne Mendelsohn about the whole story of milk in over the ages and our society and what we've done to it today. So I'm full of milk recipes. Yes.
When you get a manuscript, are you the one who goes through and makes sure that all the recipes make sense, and that, or you have somebody else who does that?
Oh, no, I do. And I work very closely on cookbooks because, you know, you can have a wonderful cook but not necessarily a great writer. So just to help bring out that voice, I think a voice is very important. And the magazines and newspapers have done everything to destroy a voice in a recipe. I mean, my favorite example, in a bowl, combine the first mixture with the second mixture, set aside. What are you going to do, throw it out? I mean, the whole thing, and then you're looking for that mixture, that first mixture. What is it? Oh, I heated the milk with a little bit of sugar in it. That became a mixture. I mean, you talk in a visceral way about food, and I love Julia's language of plop it in the bowl, massage it with your hands. So I do work very closely, and sometimes even try to watch them cook to ask questions and draw out that voice.
Was Julia good with her details? In other words,
Julia was, she was the one to talk, who taught me what to look for, if you know what I mean. She just was a natural. She had a mission, and that was to make Americans better cooks, to teach them soigner French cooking. And she got all the details right.
I just wanted to carry on with the question about Julia Child. Is it, is my understanding that she sort of quote or attributes to you her self-control? I mean, she and Simone could have written some of those things, shouldn't she, unless you kind of encouraged them to get a little bit more of American realization into things?
Well, I think it was inevitable. Two things. One, Julia so became the star that this was pretty hard for a French woman to have an American telling all America what French cooking was. So I think it was inevitable that they split and Julia write her own books. But as she did that, and Julia was always open to new ideas, I remember the first time she got what we called a robo-coup. And that was what turned into the food processor. And she was so excited about it because she just made quenelles. And she said, you know, if I had been doing it the old-fashioned way, just like me with the fish, I would have been putting hot stuff through a tamis all afternoon. And so she, I think she embraced new ideas, brought some things she loved about American food into her cookbooks, still primarily French, but...
Well, I just wanted to tell you that out in Oregon, I have a 24-year-old granddaughter, and they're living in a big house. There's two girls and four boys. Of course, they're all vegans, and the meals they put out are fantastic, very good. And on the windowsill is a large bowl of garlic, and I think everything they make starts out with, we chop some garlic. Mm-hmm. So they're living your life now.
You can
now
salvage even vegan food. Mm-hmm. It sounds
it sounds like your stay in France.
Yeah.
Will you tell us something about your other editing experiences? You could start with Anne Frank.
Oh, well, I will tell you that story. One of the last jobs I had when I was in Paris, Doubleday conveniently opened an office, and they sent over an editor and scout, really. And I heard about this and got myself hired as his girl Friday, so I did the dirty work. And one, he had a beautiful apartment on the Bois de Boulogne, and one day he was going off to have lunch with French publishers, and it was a stack of manuscripts and books, and he said, I've looked at those, will you do reject them and send them back. So I was going through writing rejection letters, and I came upon a book. It had not yet been published. It was an advanced copy. And it was this haunting face on the cover. It was the face of Anne Frank. And I started to read it. I couldn't help it. And I read all afternoon. I was still reading it when it came home when it was dark. And I said, we've got to send this to New York. They have to publish it. And my boss said, what? That book by that kid? Anyway, Doubleday did respond, and they published it. But you know, several other publishers had turned it down, too. So it wasn't, those things happen. But it was a very nice piece of luck for me to have discovered it. Yes.
I wonder if you could comment on regional cooking in France. You know, there must be quite a bit of competition between Paris and Lyon. Or mm-hmm. What are the differences? Or?
Well, I think the interesting thing, and this is true in Italy too, how distinctive the regions have managed to be and to keep that identity, even with all the fast food, and believe me, there's fast food in France too. But I don't know. I think it's just something deep in the French that they cling to that that purist and to the land. And you know that wonderful book by Waverly Root about the food of France, in which he divides France into the territory of olive oil, the territory of goose fat, the territory of butter, and that doesn't seem really to have changed. I haven't traveled as much in the country in France, I usually, in recent years, so I'm no expert, but maybe somebody else could address that.
Thank you.
Sorry.
Okay.
In recent weeks, there's been this controversy surrounding Jerry Seinfeld's wife allegedly copying another cookbook writer. I just wondered if that has ever occurred on the haute cuisine level, and how do editors and publishers protect their authors from such incidents?
Well, I learned by getting burned, because I did do a book by a male cook. I very much wanted an American male voice, a young voice, and this was a long time ago. And it turned out that at least a half dozen of his recipes had come from Peggy Harvey's book, which was a book that the Knopf had published long before I was there. But there's no way of one knowing that as an editor. If I just talk to people and say, you know, what is the source of your recipes? But the truth is, you see, there's nothing new under the sun. I mean, As I said before, recipes change according to the person doing them. So if you have, Julia Child mastering the art of French cooking, those recipes weren't new. They're classic French cooking. But she interpreted them. She translated them. And that's one thing. But if it's really just blatant theft, even using the language, then it's pretty embarrassing. And there have been some incidents I won't cite them, but that other publishers have had. It's something you have to rely on, the integrity of the author.
Hi, Ms. Jones. It's a really interesting talk. A few years ago, there was a book called Julie and Julia. Do you guys know what I'm talking about? And it was a young blogger who was trying to do all the recipes in Mastering the Art of French Cooking. Mm-hmm. And I guess my daughter, who's 22, and her friends loved that book and loved that blog. And I think it brought Julia to a whole new generation. But I heard that Julia Child, I think she wrote in the book that she heard Julia Child did not like it that she had this blog and that she'd become kind of a sensation. And I wondered if you could shed any light on that.
I can shed a lot of light.
Oops.
I heard about it when she had her blog. And in fact, she called me and asked if I would go out to watch her cook. I didn't know anything, and I agreed at a certain date. And in the meantime, I watched the blog, and I thought, this girl could not care one bit about cooking. It's all an exploitation of Julia. She's just using her, and she only has a vocabulary of four-letter words to describe. So I called up and said I would not be coming. Now, I also talked to Julia, who was still alive then, and asked her what she thought. And she looked at the blog and said, "Ooh," I can't remember the words. But so that's. However, then she went on to do a book out of this, got a huge advance from some publisher, and now they're making a movie. And Nora Ephron has written the script, and will be directing it. And Meryl Streep is going to be playing Julia. And I'm a character in it who at the last minute turned down her dinner, and here she'd made this beautiful dinner for me, and I didn't come. So I don't know. Maybe it gets people to Julia, and if so, that's just fine. But I can't really respect it. Maybe it's my age. Yeah.
Thanks for joining us on Book Tour. For more readings like this one, please go to npr.org/booktour.